Nobody's madder than me about the fact that the website isn't working as well as it should, which means it's going to get fixed.
This hour, we'll talk to computer scientists about what it will take to make good on that promise by the president. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's all about the Affordable Care Act this hour. First, we examine the technical issues surrounding the rollout of the ACA. We'll talk with two professors of computer science and engineering for their thoughts on the website's problems and possible solutions. Then we want more of your questions about the new health care law itself. We dissect the extremely bumpy rollout of Obamacare after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A few weeks after the launch of the Affordable Care Act's online health insurance exchanges, the public's impression has been that it has been a bumpy launch. Well, about 3 in 10 Americans, 29%, say the exchanges are working very or fairly well. A whopping 46% say they are not. That's according to a new survey, national survey by the Pew Research Center. Yesterday, we heard President Obama say nobody's madder than him that the website's not working like it should, and he's promised it will be fixed. Later in the hour, we want to answer your questions about the law itself, including its requirements, the process of enrolling in the health insurance exchanges online. We did this on October 1st when they first opened, and at that time we had Pete Damiano with us and Dan Shane. They will be joining us in the second half hour to answer your questions about the new health insurance law. But before we get to that, let's examine these technical issues surrounding the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. Joining us to do that, Juan Pablo Orcad. He is Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Juan Pablo, welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
Also joining us in our Ames studio, Doug Jacobson, professor of electrical and computer engineering at Iowa State and director of ISU's Information Assurance Center. Doug Jacobson, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Doug. I want to get both of your initial impressions of what's going on with this website. Doug Jacobson, what is your view based on what we're hearing, the Obama administration not being terribly forthcoming as far as what exactly the glitches are, or have you found something else?
Well, I think there's several issues, I think, that come into play. One is that I don't know what else they expected when they said that the entire country should log into the website on October 1st. Most websites aren't built to handle that large amount of volume, and especially a website like this that's A, complicated, introduces a fairly complicated concept, and B, requires that members or people trying to sign up check their eligibility, which means it has to go and check against an IRS database. Those types of things make it complicated, and to tell the entire country we're all going to log in on October 1st, I think was kind of a mistake.
So in computer science, and we're not all computer scientists, there are a few of us actually listening here, but what is a way to think about that? What is an image you can give us about when we tell the whole country or millions of people that this website's open and you can go get it? What can we picture there?
Well, a good analogy is the automobile. You look at coming home from work. We all get off work at 5 o'clock, and it's a whole lot different driving at 5 o'clock on the afternoon than it is driving at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday night. And so imagine if everybody, the entire country, all decided to get in their automobiles and get on the road at the same time. It's just not built to handle that. And then, as you know, once you get a bottleneck like that, once the roads get congested, it takes a long time for that to work itself out. So we're seeing the same type of thing with a website like that.
Juan Pablo Orcad, you specialize in human-computer interaction and have experience working for similar projects, not of this scale. But what do you make of the rollout and the technical problems?
Yes, Ben. I used to work for the federal government a few years ago, and I got to experience the contracting process for software development. And I think that the key issue that we're finding, and this is yet another example that of issues that we've seen before in similar projects, is that the project hasn't really followed modern software engineering techniques or user-centered design methods. Mm-hmm. And part of the issue is the way government does contracting for large software development projects.
What do you mean by that, by not following the path that, that software companies would normally follow?
So normally for software companies, you would first of all, if you're trying to make a technology for a large number of people, and in this case, many people who perhaps if they're low income, maybe don't have high information technology literacy. You really need to start out by understanding what people are looking for, what information they can provide, how can you make things work well for them. And you build your requirements up from that. And what you do is you go through several stages, several iterations of refining your requirements, and then begin with prototypes, refining those, getting feedback from all stakeholders at each step. And that makes it much more likely that you're going to end up with a good product, something that people can use. And it has the added value that the earlier you find problems, the less expensive they're to fix.
So you're pointing out this is much different than the government ordering a widget or, let's say, a bulletproof vest, where you don't need that sort of interaction as you develop it.
Yeah, there's a lot more complexity. And the problem is the way the government does contracting for the most part is that it hands the contractors with a set of specifications for what they need to build. Now, the problem is it's very, very unlikely that those specifications are going to be correct because in modern software engineering, we really expect those requirements and those specifications to change over time as you get feedback. And you grow them from a small set to a very large set. Mm-hmm. And we have seen this before. It's not the first time this happens. This one happens to be a very visible example.
Well, what is it, an earlier example you can point to?
Well, one of the best-known ones, and depending on your age, you might remember it, is the FAA, their Advanced Automation System. This started in the early 80s under the Reagan administration. And basically by 2002, about $1.5 billion were wasted on software that was never used. And if you look at the reports from the GAO and others, very similar issues. About 10 years ago, the FBI had the virtual case file. Same problems.
And you were involved personally, were you not, with a failed technology for the Census Bureau?
Yeah. So about 10 years ago, again, the Census Bureau was strongly considering using handheld computers for the 2010 census. And they started developing systems internally, and then eventually they contracted out. And again, it was the same problems. We ended up with requirements documents that were hundreds of pages long. Nobody completely understood them. And I remember going to the first meeting for that project and just seeing the way the methods and the process was going to follow. I told people this is going to be a train wreck in slow motion. And it was very frustrating to be there and not be able to change the way things were being done.
Doug Jacobson, let me ask you about this, because we have some states running their own health insurance exchange websites, others letting the federal government do it. Could this also be feeding into the difficulties we're experiencing, not that we're not having one uniform system for all states?
I mean, that can be feeding into it to a certain extent. Actually, there was an article today in the Des Moines Register about, you know, if the state had done it themselves, you wouldn't have these problems. And some of that would be, well, there's less users in particular states. But it was already, as was pointed out, this is a very, very complex system they're trying to stand up, from a user trying to understand a brand new law, trying to understand how they qualify, and then putting them in front of a website that may not have been designed for certain users. And there's no guarantee that a state would do it any better. I mean, states contract, as was pointed out, the contracting process for software is a little difficult because you can't specify it. And so there's no guarantee a state would have done a better job.
So really all you can specify in this type of product is what? The goal? The eventual goal?
You're trying to test, you know, ideally you want to test and try out websites and try out the user. You know, you have focus groups and you know, there are processes in place for doing that. But, you know, this was wrapped up in trying to get something stood up by a certain deadline. And, a massive rollout like this is difficult to do.
And Doug Jacobson, there are two parts of this website. Explain what those are.
Well, you have the part of the website that gives out information. You know, there's a lot of what we often call static information, something that doesn't change, talks about the law, talks about, you know, how things work, how the exchanges work. And then there's the part where you need to become a user. You need to log in, create a login, and then you pick your plan, and then you have to be verified based on income, you know, to how many subsidies you receive. And that information pulls out from things like the IRS database. Mm. So this system has to interact with other systems, which is very common. But that's often the bottleneck, is when you start to interact with other systems that may not have been designed to handle the load. You know, if you triple or quadruple the load to a back-end system like the IRS database, it may not be able to handle that increasing number of requests.
Mm. Juan Pablo Orcad, you've been to the website and sort of looked at what parts work and what not. And I think in our brief conversation before we went on the air, you've actually rolled this out for your class as a learning tool.
Yes. We went through it in my human-computer interaction class today, and I tried it out twice yesterday too. I'll give a little bit of good news. It has good graphic design, very pleasant. So that they did a good job with that. Overall, the part where you get information on the available plans that are available local plans, that seems to be working. It's inefficient. I had to go through 9 screens to actually see a listing of plans here in Iowa City, for example, where I think it would have been much better if you just had a little place in the homepage where you could put in your zip code and just get the listings and then do the filtering afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually worked. I would imagine people would be able to go through that without any major issues. The part that's very concerning is the registration procedure. I tried that out yesterday twice, today again in my class. It didn't work any of those times.
What actually happened?
First time I tried it yesterday, it seemed to be successful, but then I wasn't able to log in and I didn't get any email confirmation. And then when I tried it yesterday evening, it gave me an error, actually, which is better than making people think that it worked when it actually didn't. That actually is a bit of a long process. It was seven screens to create an account. And this all it's asking really is for your name, the county you live in, and your email address. And then you have to create a username and a password. The requirements for the username and password were very confusing. We were actually looking at it in my class today, and my students and I were very confused as to what was allowed and what wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a process of trial and error. I imagine if it confuses us, it's going to be incredibly confusing for your typical user. So that's a challenge. It's not working. It doesn't seem to be very well designed for a majority of people out there.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like when you talk with your students and talk about human-computer interaction and you say do's and don'ts, this is currently a lot of the don't examples you can draw from this website in terms of efficiency and the other points that you mentioned.
Well, I mean, one of the challenges I have in my classes sometimes is that students tell me, well, you know, that's obvious. It's obvious that you should do it this way or that you should follow this kind of process. And this is a great case study of how not to do things.
What did you think, Doug Jacobson, about the interface? Have you been to view the user interface for this website?
No, I haven't had an opportunity to try it yet.
What makes a user interface user friendly or not user friendly?
Well, I mean, in this case, you're looking at first time and novice users, mm-hmm. so you want to make things as simple as possible, have few available actions, speak the user's language. And make things as simple and efficient as you can make them at the same time. Mm-hmm. You want to reassure people. I think with one challenge right now is that with all the challenges people are having getting in, it may affect the trust that people have in the system.
And Doug Jacobson, that's sort of your area as director of ISU's Information Assurance Center, isn't it? Because if you have this many problems collecting basic information – if you think one step further, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence that the information you put in there will be treated securely, does it?
Yeah. As soon as websites start to fail, they don't report back what's going on. You know, you don't know if you get an account. Yeah, you're going to start to not trust that that site. And when it starts to, you know, the site again has to verify certain income requirements and so on. And you could see where people are going to be leery of is this site really going to keep my data? Is it going to be secure? Even if it is secure, there's still going to be doubts. You know, anytime something fails like that.
We have a couple minutes left, and I want to get to both of your views on what should be done at this. Of course, we wish we could turn the clock back. Those people wanting to use these sites more than anyone. Doug Jacobson, do you see as possible solutions going forward? We had your traffic, your car analogy there.
Yeah.
I guess how fast you build wider roads and on-ramps and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're continuing to work on it, but it's kind of hard to fix it on the fly now that people are using it. You could try. I think one thing might, at least from the load standpoint, is maybe try to back in the remember the days of the gas rationing when you're even numbered license plates and odd numbered license plates.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of an external process like that might deal with the bottleneck issue, but as also pointed out, there's some real serious design flaws in the whole usability.
So you're suggesting, I think, to lessen the load, like I have with my parent-teacher conferences when I go, it's like people with last names A through D should go on this time and to this place, and then you split up the people.
Yeah, that would be one way you could at least eliminate that, some of that bottleneck problem is Mondays or this day. And it's not like there's there is a deadline, but the deadline's months away to have this accomplished. It's not like we're all competing for a limited number of spots. Everybody's they want everybody to participate. So you don't have to get signed up tomorrow.
Okay. Juan Pablo Orcad, someone from the Obama administration calls you after this interview when you get back to your office and says, we want you on our A-team. What are you going to suggest? What's the way forward?
I think what I would tell them is make lemonade out of lemons. Make this an opportunity to actually fix the way the federal government contracts out for software development, because this is bound to happen again unless we have a serious conversation about how to fix it.
So this is not reflective of this particular administration. This is reflective of bureaucracy and government in general?
It's the way government contracts for software development. It's going to keep happening. This is a very well-known example, but it's happened many times before. It's going to keep happening. I think one of the big challenges is, and this is my own opinion, just to get more people in leadership positions who understand technology, because it's going to be a greater and a greater part of government. And if our leaders don't understand how to use it, government's is going to be hurt.
You both agree that there were probably missing IT information people in those leadership roles, it sounds like. Doug Jacobson?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that
otherwise, the red flags would have gone up.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception that, we just put together a website. It's something easy to do, right? You can, there's TV ads, right? You just go to buildmywebsite.com and you have a website.
Okay. We'll see how this goes, see how these glitches get cleared up or not. Doug Jacobson, professor of electrical and computer engineering at ISU, director of ISU's Information Assurance Center. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Juan Pablo Orcad, associate professor of computer science at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming into our Iowa City studio.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And for the rest of the program, we'd like to find out how these technical problems are affecting individuals. You, for instance, have you tried to sign up at the Affordable Care Act website, healthcare.gov? What's been your experience? Get in touch with us. We want to talk about individual stories. The rest of the hour, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Before we get to your calls and some other experts in this field, let's turn to the implications of the new law for seniors in particular and a few older Iowans that our own Sarah McCammon has been in touch with for a feature this week. Sarah joins me now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Ben.
You talked with a couple of people in a feature, and let's hear a little bit about them. But before we do that, The idea behind the Affordable Care Act is that risk is spread more widely than before. Tell us about that.
Right. So one of the things the Affordable Care Act does is it doesn't allow insurers to deny people coverage because of pre-existing conditions. But in order to avoid, you know, just a massive uptick in costs for insurance companies, the risk has to be spread out across the population. So really one of the big goals is to bring younger, healthier people who are cheaper to insure, don't have as many medical expenses in. That means everybody has to get coverage. And then, of course, the Affordable Care Act also includes some provisions for helping people afford to do that, subsidies and tax credits and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And you actually talked to a few individuals who are older Iowans. What did you find?
Right. Well, of course, at 65, Medicare eligibility, the federal program for seniors, kicks in. But a lot of people before they get to that are, you know, either wanting or needing to retire, perhaps for health conditions, or maybe you wouldn't run into couples. One of the couples I talked to, Terry LaBelle and her husband, they live in Altoona. He's about 3 years older than her. He's 60. She's 57. They both have had health problems. He works at Lowe's and she's a child care provider. And they're looking down the road. They're going, you know, they're very expensive to insure out of pocket because of some past health issues. And when he hits 65 or if he needs to retire before then, they're worried about how to get coverage. You know, in the past, even if he had waited till 65 to retire, she'd still be 62 and she would be left without health insurance if he gave up his employer coverage and went on Medicare. So that was the first couple I talked with. And then I also spoke with a woman in Des Moines, Kathy Wilkinson Barish, who is 64 and is on disability, but she had a long career as a writer and photographer and had to go on disability. And it currently has some coverage through her former employer, but that will run out before she ages into Medicare. So a bit of a coverage gap there.
Mm-hmm. And how are each of these people, these families, doing as far as signing up in the website? Have both of them attempted that?
Well, the first couple I talked to, you know, they're not at a point where they need that yet, but they're thinking about it and looking ahead to that. Terry LaBelle said she's 57, I think, as I mentioned, and she said she's a little uncomfortable with the website but planning to get help from her daughter-in-law. So I don't think she's dug into it real deeply yet. But Kathy Wilkinson Barish, you know, she's worked on computers for a long time as a writer and I think is pretty comfortable with them, but she's had a really hard time trying to get a sense of what her rates might be.
Just to try and get an account, it's please wait, you know, and the little arrow goes around and around and around, and you know, my computer, it's like it. I feel like I'm back in, you know, 20 years ago on my first word processor, where if I wanted to move a paragraph, I could go up and make dinner and come down, and the paragraph would be moved.
So, yeah, just a lot of difficulty getting onto the website to even get an estimate for insurance rates, she said.
Okay, we'll be exploring for the rest of the hour others, perhaps, who've had good or bad experiences on the Affordable Care Act, the healthcare.gov website. But for now, Sarah McCammon, thank you for sharing these stories with us of Iowans interested in healthcare coverage.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're going to take a short break and then come back and talk more about the Affordable Care Act. Have you tried to sign up at the website, healthcare.gov? We want to hear your experience, your questions. No politics today, by the way, on this show about the Affordable Care Act. Tomorrow is Politics Day. Boy, you better believe we're going to talk about the political fallout of this bungled rollout. And technical issues aside, what questions do you have about the Affordable Care Act? When we come back, we'll talk about those with Pete Damiano and Dan Shane, 1-866-780-9100. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, Politics Day, well, President Obama earlier this week vowing to fix the embarrassing launch of the insurance exchanges under his signature health care law. Tomorrow we ask the question, how bad is the political fallout? How bad will it be? Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us tomorrow on the program. Also, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. And did you know Senator Ted Cruz will be speaking on Friday in Des Moines at the Iowa GOP Reagan dinner? Tomorrow on this program, we'll size up his prospects for 2016. What about Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton? There's something we could jawbone a lot about on Politics Day. We'll see if that comes up. Today, talking about the Affordable Care Act, politics aside, the website that's meant to allow Americans to shop and sign up for new medical plans under the Affordable Care Act isn't working as well as it should. President Obama says he's promised, in fact, that the problems will be fixed, and he says it will bring many benefits that aren't tied to those problems. This half hour, we want to continue our discussion about the law itself. Last half hour was the technical problems. We got into the machinery to see what's clogging it up. This half hour, we want to talk about the law itself, including the requirements, the process of enrolling. They were with us on October 1st when this whole thing began. Pete Damiano is director of the Public Policy Center, professor in the Department of Preventive and Community Dentistry at the University of Iowa. Pete Damiano, welcome back to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon. Dan Shane with us as well. Again, assistant professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Dan, thank you for coming into our studio again.
Happy to be here, Ben.
This half hour, we want to reach out to our listeners. Have you tried to sign up on the website, healthcare.gov? What has been your experience? What questions do you have about this brand new healthcare law that have to do with the electronic enrollment or perhaps are apart from that? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You'll find us, Iowa Public Radio, also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, we have to talk a little bit about the public policy implications, I think, of what's happened in the intervening time since you gentlemen have been in our studio. Let me start with you, Pete Damiano. What do you see as implications of this bumpy technical rollout in Obamacare?
Well, there's going to be obviously some short-term and some longer-term implications. The short-term that people are concerned about is obviously, are people going to get turned off from trying to apply? And in particular, the younger, healthier people, the concern is if they, because of this delay, that they decide, well, I really didn't want it that much anyways, I'll just pay the penalty. It'll be relatively cheap, even though the cost of the plans for the under 30s has come in lower than what most people expected. But if they don't join, it throws off the actuarial calculations and the cost estimates for everybody else. And then longer term, I would suspect that this will sort of – we'll be moving on to other crisis issues related to healthcare, but I think right now it's just a question of how long this is going to take and what the, you know, what that might actually mean for people trying.
Dan Shane, I think you can talk a little bit about the implications of this problematic rollout for insurance companies, their sort of perspective on what's been going on.
Absolutely. That when insurance companies submitted their bids in terms of the premiums, they had an expectation, as Pete mentioned, about the overall health of the group that would eventually become insured under their policies. Anything that puts a roadblock in terms of people gaining health insurance or signing up for the health insurance, you start thinking about who's more likely to overcome these roadblocks. And if those are the people who really need health insurance, they may have some pre-existing conditions, for example. They know that they're going to have a lot more spending. If that group becomes much more likely even than usual in terms of the overall proportion who sign up for coverage, then insurance companies are going to be concerned. What we actually have some evidence, though, which suggests that in this case procrastination might be our friend.
Evidence in what form?
From the rollout of Massachusetts, which again was virtually the exact same plan that has been scaled up to our national ACA plan.
Don't tell Mitt Romney that, though, right?
That's correct.
but okay, so we saw the rollout of that, and that happened when?
2007 was when that rolled out. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to look at the pattern in terms of who was signing up. As you might expect, the proportion of the early enrollees in Massachusetts were those who were more likely to have chronic conditions, more likely to spend more in a given month. And then as the mandate became more and more pressing, so that there was these deadlines when you had to get coverage, and then there was an extra couple months where you didn't have to have coverage, mm-hmm. but that the drop-dead point when you actually had a penalty, there was a surge, and that surge in enrollments was much more the young, healthier folks. So they mm-hmm. were younger, they were less likely to have chronic conditions. So I think what that – in terms of evidence, that shows us that we have a bit more time at least to – the administration has a bit more time to get the website correct. The December 15th becomes an important date. perhaps even for the real procrastinators, February 15th. So you have coverage by March 1st.
Pete Damiano.
So in Iowa's done, I think, a really smart effort with the folks who were in the Iowa Care program before. And the Iowa Care program is a plan with about 70,000 people between, and these are the single adults who were not eligible for Medicaid before, and they were the ones who tended to have multiple chronic comorbid conditions, mental health, physical health problems. And rather than having them sort of find their own way, they've decided to auto-enroll as many of those people as possible into the new Medicaid expansion program, what they call the Iowa Wellness Program for under 100% of poverty, or the Iowa Choice Plan from 100 to 133%. So those really sick group of the uninsured will already be sort of ahead of the game and won't have to try to manage the site, as we talked about the last time we were here from our study about the people that are going to be going into the marketplace are the ones that have the most challenge using a computer online as well as having experience with insurance, et cetera. So that's going to really help in Iowa.
Shannon on our Facebook page posted this. I waited until October 5th because I knew there would be a traffic jam the first few days. I had no issues settling up an account or anything else, writes Shannon, once I figured out how to navigate the site. I don't think it was really as complicated as some are saying, writes Shannon. I know there are plenty of issues that need to be addressed, but I am thankful to finally have access to affordable health care. I am self-employed and have not had insurance for a few years because I could not afford it. Thank you, Shannon, on our Facebook page. You can also get us feedback if you've tried to sign up on the website healthcare.gov, or perhaps you just have a question about the new healthcare law. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to David. David, listening in Cedar Rapids, welcome to our program.
Yeah. Shannon may be the one person that was able to sign up in Iowa.
There are a few who get through the bottleneck. Perhaps Shannon
I can get an account. I can get. Yeah. I can go back in and log in and try again, and I get stopped every time. I've never seen what's available in Linn County until 3 days ago when they put the button on that lets you look without logging in.
And
maybe Shannon got in. Maybe Shannon.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, how many times have you tried this?
Dozens. I started the very night it opened about 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's gotten steadily better. But
better in what way?
You can get farther.
farther down the road before you're stopped. Pete Damiano, right. What can we tell David about what he should do now, advice for him?
Basically, perseverance is really what it takes. There is, and he mentioned some of the changes that have been made, which have been really important to the site, because I, like he, have been trying since day one to try to enroll. And initially, there was a security site where you're supposed to, like, add your mother's maiden name, because they decided they didn't want to give people bad information, and so they needed all the personal information right up front, which was obviously very sensitive. But then there were glitches in that, so that, as the caller mentioned, we now have the opportunity. You can just choose your state, county, age, and we'll tell you what types of plans are available and give you better cost estimates. So at least you can get a sense, where before they just had this Kaiser Family Foundation calculator, which was, again, better than nothing. But this is a much better step. There's the call-in option, but it's still got a ways to go.
Have you tried that, David, the call-in option?
Oh, I've called them several times, and I had to call Experian twice. Mm. But the guy who was just speaking, did he manage to sign in? And
Pete Damiano, both of our guests today, Pete and Dan, have both been on the site. So what have you been experienced, Pete?
I was not able to get all the way through yet either myself.
So same experience as you, David. You're not
it
alone.
Me.
Okay. We hope you fare better in the future, David. Thank you for sharing your experience from Cedar Rapids.
Sure. Thanks.
Ryan is in Waukee. Hi, Ryan. How have you fared? Or do you just have a question about the new healthcare law?
I think it was just when he was, campaigning for it. Maybe I don't remember this properly, but I thought the penalty was only going to be for people who make under a certain amount of money. Is that right? or is like I make maybe 40 this year. I'm self-employed, and I'm actually looking forward to this. I've looked at some websites, and I want to sign up. It looks like I should save some money.
Mm-hmm. Okay, making about 40, self-employed. Ryan, how does the penalty apply here or to others as well?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would suggest is go to the site and use that sort of simple calculation so you can see what the plan cost would be in your area. The penalty isn't just for lower income people. In fact, most of the lower income people, you know, under 133% of poverty will automatically qualify without a cost, except we can get into the technical specifics, but there's a monthly premium if you don't do a physical exam and a risk assessment starting in year two. But there is also a hardship if you still can't afford it if you're, you know, above the automatic ones. And then from there, it's based on a proportion of your income. But it is still relatively low in the first year and then will ramp up from there.
Yeah, actually, so the bare minimum is $95 in terms of the penalty for not having coverage. But again, that's the lowest possible. It's whatever is higher in terms of 1% of your income or $95. So mm-hmm. Someone who made $40,000 would be faced with around $400 in terms of the penalty for not having coverage.
Okay, did we fill in some blanks for you, Ryan?
Yeah, and I went to like coopportunityhealth.com. Is it pretty much going to be the same thing if I go to the healthcare.gov? I just do the calculator there on their website. And it looks like I'll save some money even with like the silver plan, like quite a bit. I'm looking at like $600 in savings, and I think some of that's going to be a subsidy.
Dan Shane.
So is there going to be a difference between websites?
Okay, let's let Dan Shane go for that one.
In terms of the plans, they should be a plan that is available both on Co-Opportunity's website and the federal government website. But the only way you'll know if you qualify for tax credits will be if you go to the federal government website. So my expectation, and I don't know this for sure, is that the plans will look very similar. Co-Opportunity has come into being just as a result of the ACA and the exchanges. But in terms of whether you qualify for tax credits, that would come from the federal site only.
Dan Shane is in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Pete Damiano, our other guest, Director of Public Policy Center, professor in the Department of Preventive and Community Dentistry at the University of Iowa. 1-866-780-9100 to ask your questions about the Affordable Care Act. Before we go to our next caller, Pete, you wanted to jump in with a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted – Dan raised a very important point for people. You can get insurance other places that meet the specifications of a minimum coverage, but you will only get the tax subsidy if you're under 400% of poverty going through the official healthcare website, so the healthcare.gov. So that's real important.
They have to verify the income that you give to them. So
right.
Okay, understood. Let's go to Tom in Dubuque. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the opportunity. I work for what would be considered a large business. We're over 50 employees. And one of the bit of the information that has filtered down through the company is that because we are self-insured, part of the policy is that we would be assessed a fee in the $30,000 range because we're a larger business and we're self-insured. Do you understand that part of the policy of the Obamacare plan and why is that? And if you don't, would there be a place where I could just read up on that?
I think Dan Shane has something to say about that anyway. Tom?
I believe what you're referring to is the reinsurance plan. And so all insurance plans, including self-insured plans, in the first couple years of the ACA and the exchanges are being assessed fees that will go into a fund that will be there for risk adjustments. So the idea that one health insurance plan gets – a larger proportion of the unhealthy enrollees. Remember, what we've done here is tie insurance companies' hands in terms of managing risk. They can no longer underwrite. They can no longer restrict based on pre-existing conditions. So they have a much more limited ability to manage risk. Understanding the possibility that the – coincidentally enough that the exchanges might be slow to get started, the healthier might be slower to enroll, there's this sort of contingency fund that's being collected from all insurance companies. So it's insurance companies making each other whole based on some getting
an adverse selection.
They're
pooling money now, even before this goes into effect.
That's correct. So policies that would be rolled over for 2014 would be subject to this.
Right. But you also raised a really good point about the difference between self-insured companies and people that are literally going out and purchasing insurance. And most of these changes are aimed at those people who are in the individual and small business market that go down to a Farm Bureau office in their community or an agent and purchase a health insurance plan where if they've had a pre-existing condition or they got sick during the year, they might have been dropped. Or if they're a small business and they had six employees and somebody got sick and they had to make a decision about dropping coverage for everybody or that employee. And that's a big distinction.
Okay. Is there another place that Tom may have some unanswered questions, a place we can direct Tom for more information as an employee of a larger company?
I mean, my suggestion would really be talking to your HR people at your company.
Okay. Tom, thank you for your input today.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Chris in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
So I feel that people will be able to get signed up and these glitches will eventually work out. But I'm wondering what you think about Iowa's provider capacity to see these newly enrolled people, especially those who are more vulnerable.
Okay. So up to this point, great point, Chris, because up to this point, the people who are without insurance just do without until what, Pete Damiano, until they end up in an emergency room.
Right. They often do get care, but they get it later. They get it when they're sicker, and they often get it in a more costly site, like you mentioned, with an emergency department. We're actually doing a study funded by the Commonwealth Fund looking at the impact of the ACA on the safety net and the safety net providers. And as Dan was mentioning earlier about Massachusetts, what we've learned from there is even though we're providing insurance coverage, the need for the safety net providers there actually went up rather than went down because we're driving more people into private insurance than into public insurance with this approach, this individual mandate approach with the subsidized private insurance in the marketplaces. And so then the private sector gets even more overloaded with people with private insurance, if you will, and then more people are going to be coming to the community health centers, the federally qualified health centers, the rural health clinics, the Title X family planning clinics, community-based mental health centers, free clinics, et cetera, because there may or may not be enough providers. So that is going to be an issue and how we deal with that.
Finally, this hour, before we have to go, I guess a question I have to believe is on many people's minds who want to sign up. And we heard from Shannon who waited 5 days. She waited till October 5th to sign up. Now, we're in this situation now. It's all over the news that the website continues to improve but has significant problems as of this date. Dan Shane, what can we say? Should people wait because the deadline is quite a ways off and wait till that experience online of signing up improves?
I think that's probably the wisest advice is to keep tabs on it. You now have the ability to go in by county and at least shop for plans without actually signing up and registering on the website. So that should give you an idea of what plans are available. You won't know at that point whether you qualify for tax credits. But again, and I think going back to your original point, there probably is less harm in waiting. Procrastination may be our friend, at least in terms of getting as many people signed up for coverage.
Right. In the current circumstances, that means fewer people trying to get through those existing bottlenecks before they are widened here too. Pete Damiano, I understand on Sunday you gave a talk about the Affordable Care Act. Where was that?
That was at it was part of a Midwest Regional Dental Public Health Conference that we invited. This was specifically about the impact of the ACA on oral health care and on dental care. And yeah, it's very interesting because I do a lot of these talks with community groups as part of our community outreach efforts from the Public Policy Center. And it does seem like people are the plan is finally here. And so their interest and their engagement is at a different level now, which is good. And so instead of just the political aspects of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, they're really, okay, what is this in it? What's in it for me? How do I do it? What are the plans? What are the cost implications? And that's really where we want to be, you know, for those of us in the policy world.
Okay, I want to thank you. This won't be the last time that you'll be on these airwaves because there are plenty of problems, plenty of questions to clear up. Pete Damiano is the director of the Public Policy Center, professor in the Department of Preventive and Community Dentistry at the University of Iowa. Dan Shane, assistant professor in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Our computer scientists last half hour were using this in the classroom. I wonder if either of you are using this in the classroom. No? Pete or Stan? Yeah.
I've certainly used the ACA itself many, many times. I don't know that – maybe we can get into a conversation about when healthy people sign up for coverage versus the less healthy people sign up for coverage during our next session.
Right, and absolutely about trying to get students as well as healthcare providers to understand what are the implications of this, because the delivery system changes about – we talked about last time about accountable care organization development. A lot of these things outside of the insurance coverage are actually huge.
Okay. We'll look forward to our future conversations about the health care insurance, the new health care law. Pete and Dan, thank you again so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Want a reminder, tomorrow we take on the political side of this issue. We'll get analysis from our political scientists, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University, about the political fallout of this bad rollout on the electronic website for the Affordable Care Act. Also, we'll talk about Senator Ted Cruz speaking Friday in Des Moines. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Garrett Van Leeuwen helped us out in Ames. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.